40 greetings to all of our Voice of America listeners. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
We begin with two big sporting announcements in the past day. Basketball star Amadi Stoudemire has announced that he is retiring from the National Basketball Association. The 14-year veteran announced the end of his NBA career yesterday after signing a contract with the New York Knicks so that he could retire as a member of the team. Now, while Stoudemire's NBA career may be over, his days of playing basketball could still continue. That's because Stoudemire is reportedly considering several offers to play basketball overseas, potentially in China or in Israel, on a team that he co-owns. Stoudemire played for four teams in his career, the Phoenix Suns, New York Knicks, as we mentioned, the Dallas Mavericks, and the Miami Heat. He's a six-time All-Star and boasts 15,994 points, 6,632 rebounds, and 1,054 blocks. And another big name is leaving his sport, at least until 2017. Late yesterday, tennis great Roger Federer announced in a post on his Facebook page that he'll be out for the rest of the year in order to recover from a lingering knee injury. That means that Federer will miss the Olympics in Rio, where he was set to represent his home country as Switzerland, as well as the last major tournament of the year, the U.S. Open. But Federer made it clear, while he's out for 2016, he's not out forever, writing in his Facebook post, quote, "The doctors advise that if I want to play on the ATP World Tour injury-free for another few years, as I intend to do, I must give both my knee and my body the proper time to recover." He adds, "The love I have for tennis, the competition, the tournaments, and of course you, the fans, remains intact. I am as motivated as ever and plan to put all my energy towards coming back strong, healthy, and in shape to play attacking tennis in 2017. Federer, considered by many to be the greatest male tennis player of all time, is only one of three men with more than 1,000 match wins, with a career singles record of 1,080 wins, 245 losses. He holds 17 Grand Slam singles titles, the most of any man, and 88 career singles titles. And a Sunny Side of Sports thanks to our Tadi Abeje for those facts about both Stoudemire and Federer. Well, Roger Federer may be out of the Olympics, but Steve Johnson is very much in. Johnson, ranked 21st in the world, was one of four members of the U.S. Olympics men's tennis team announced on July 15th. The others include 26th-ranked Jack Sock, Brian Baker, and Dennis Kudla. All four members of the U.S. men's single team were competing at the City Open tennis tournament this past week in Washington, D.C., where VOA caught up with Steve Johnson and asked him if he was excited about making his Olympic debut for the United States.
Yeah, super exciting. You know, anytime you get a chance to represent your country in an event like the Olympics, you know, really is an honor. And I think it's going to be even more fun for me because I have a lot of friends from USC that are also going to the Olympics, you know, from other countries and other sports. So it's like a brotherhood, you know, at USC, and we're a big family. So I've already been in touch with a bunch of other, you know, fellow Trojans, and hopefully we'll get a chance to support each other down there.
Speaking of the team, can you sum up the Team America vibe among the men participating in the tennis?
I think it's great. You know, we have a great group of guys. You know, Mike and Bob will be the leaders. They're the oldest guys on the team. They've played, I want to say, you know, this will be their fourth. So, you know, we're going to look to those guys for, you know, maybe if we get a little nervous or those guys to kind of calm us down. But, you know, Jack's a great player. Dennis, Ryan Baker, all of us are accomplished tennis players. And we're going to go down there, push each other. And I know we're going to, you know, hopefully play well and play for each other.
In addition to singles, you're going to be playing doubles. So it's double duty, no pun.
Yeah, double duty, you know, is great. You know, Jack and I had a good win last night. You know, we're just trying to work out the kinks. You know, we don't often play together. Just, you know, we always play with, you know, our own partners, and Ivashik and myself and Sam. And But I think we can be a great team. You know, hopefully we can work out the kinks here this week and get to Rio and, you know, go guns blazing.
Steve, could you give us your thoughts and strategy about playing doubles with Jack Sock at the Olympics?
Yeah, there's a lot of nuances and stuff that go into doubles. You know, I serve, what does he do best at the net? You know, he serves, what do I do best at the net? How do we win return points? How do we situate ourselves on the court? How do we take certain balls? You know, there's a lot that goes into it. And, you know, maybe to the average, you know, casual fan, you know, there's a lot more movement than they're used to on the doubles court. But, you know, you can practice a lot. But, I mean, even if we would have lost last night, I know, you know, him and I talked and our coaches talked, and, you know, we figured out, you know, what works, what doesn't work. You know, now we're going to get another match, or hopefully more, to go out there and work out a few more kinks. And look, I think we can be dangerous, but, you know, also we could lose to anybody. You know, that's tennis. That's how good everybody is. So hopefully we go out there and just, you know, play good tennis, you know, for a week straight.
Steve, do you consider the City Open to be a dry run for the Olympics?
No, they're all the same. I mean, look, the Olympics in tennis is no different. They're all the same guys. Just, you know, we're all going to go from here to Toronto, and then we're all going to go from Toronto down there, and then from, you know, Rio back to Cincy. So same draw, same guys, just a different place, you know. So looking forward to it.
One other question. Did you have any concerns about Zika or security? If so, how'd you work it out?
You know, I haven't really thought about it, but, you know, you get closer and closer. You start reading more and more articles, and, you know, I'm not too worried. I feel like it's been, you know, Zika's probably been down there for, you know, longer than, you know, a lot longer than, you know, I think everybody has been worried about it, and there's never been a problem before. So I'm not too concerned. You know, it's something that, you know, I'm not going to think too much about. And for the safety standpoint, you know, it's the Olympics. I'm going to assume they're going to have the best people down there. And I guess, you know, you're just as safe here as you are down there. I mean, it's, you know, this day and age in the world, you know, you never know what could happen.
And our thanks to Sunnyside of Sports producer Bill Werkinger, who you heard there speaking with Steve Johnson in that interview. Well, another athlete excited for the upcoming Olympics is Thea LaFond, who will be representing Dominica in the triple jump. All this week, we've heard from LaFond as she's talked with our Sonny Young and Ben Cento about her first ever trip to the Olympic Games. Today, we dig deeper into Thea LaFond's sporting career, including how she got involved with track and field, and it all began with a trip from her home country to the United States.
I was born April 5th, 1994, on that beautiful little island in the Caribbean, Dominica. And when I was around 5, 6 years old, my father and mother decided to move to the States. Now, we had already had family that had moved before us, and they lived in New Jersey. So we packed up our bags and moved to New Jersey. My father found work selling cars, and my mother began working at a Job Corps. For there, we lived there for 2 years, and then my father got a job working at the USDA, down the street. And now my mother is a professor. So because, you know, my dad was working at DC, we decided to move to Maryland. The commute would be shorter, and that's where we've called home. And so far, so good. We've been here for like 12 years. So we very much love it, and that's where, you know, we've made new family friends, and we have grown so much since then.
Let's get back to your family. You talked about them earlier. How have they reacted to you going to the Olympics?
My family they were just in shock, I think, the same as much as I was. My family, we are very religious-based, and when I told my mother, she didn't even say congrats. She just started thanking God. And I think it's because we've just gone through so much. I mean, immigrating to the U.S. is never an easy feat, especially when you're not familiar with your surroundings, completely different culture. And for her, I think my mother especially, was a confirmation that all the hard work, all the sacrifices were paying off for her children. So they were so happy. We have a massive family. My dad's 1 out of 10. My mom's out of 7. And the calls coming in were just overwhelming. And it was just awesome because it was at that moment I really felt that I had brought honor to my family. And there's no better feeling than that of making especially your mom and your dad proud.
That's really good. So how'd you get started in the sport?
On accident. So before I did track, I actually was a classically trained dancer. I did tap, jazz, and ballet. And I started high school, and my mom decided to stop, you know, me from dancing. She pulled me out of my dance classes simply because it was very expensive. Ballet is not cheap. And though I was very good at it, she was like, well, you know, you are very athletic. Let's find another sport for you. So I started volleyball.
Okay.
And that coach kind of realized that I had some ups. And and so once that season was over, there was a co-ed volleyball team, but I wasn't sure I wanted to do that. So I decided that I was probably just going to be like a manager of a team, basketball team at the school. And so I went to the coach and told him what I wanted to do. I told him I'd like to be the manager of your team. And he looked at me and laughed, and he was like, go find a sport to play. You look athletic. I said, okay. Most of my friends had started doing track and field. I really didn't know what it was and what it entailed. I didn't even understand what the field part was. I just knew what a track was. So they talked me into joining. And first day of practice, I jumped in with the distance kids because I thought I would be a pretty good multiple miler. Half a lap into that first workout, the head coach pulls me aside and he goes, not to be, you know, condescending, but I feel like you might be a little faster than you think you are. And he put a couple hurdles in my lane and told me to copy what one of my teammates were doing, older teammate was doing, and he was like, you know, we're going to keep you over hurdles for a while, see if you can do some sprints. And that's how it started. So good peer pressure is what got me into this sport and my mother's want to keep me busy.
Stay tuned tomorrow for the final part of our interview, where Thea talks about everything from her dual citizenship to her training regime to the comparison between college and international competition. Well, that first jog on the track, the first step onto a balance beam, and the first jump into a pool. Every athlete has to start somewhere, even the greatest Olympic athlete of all time. For Michael Phelps, who holds the record for most Olympic gold medals by any athlete ever, that start came with a woman named Kathy Bennett. Bennett was Michael Phelps' first swim coach and now serves as a board member on the Michael Phelps Foundation. Earlier this month, I interviewed Kathy Bennett on the hashtag VOA television program about Phelps' preparation for Rio, his fifth trip to an Olympic Games, and how Phelps is using his foundation to promote swimming around the world.
Well, I was actually Michael's, as you said, first coach. So I have known Michael since he was five. I taught him how to swim as a learn to swim piece of the beginning of his career. I am in conversation with him because we're in business together. I am the director of the Michael Phelps Swim School, as well as work with the foundation, as you stated. But we are all very excited for these next 30 days. As he stated, he has a lot of work to do, and I'm sure he'll do it and perform even better at the Olympics than he did at Olympic trials.
And as a sports fan, I'm very excited as well to watch him and hope he does well there. But tell us a little bit about the Michael Phelps Foundation, because maybe people don't really know what that's all about.
Right. So this is another piece of Michael. When he, maybe 8 or 10 years ago, he started saying that he wanted to bring swimming to more people. And he has definitely done that. We have a swim program where we have affiliates and swim schools in various parts of the United States. And then we also work through Michael's Foundation. And Michael's Foundation has a program, which is called the IM program, named after his, you know, most famous events, 400 IM and 200 IM. Also, it's to give the children and people taking the class, I am safe, I am strong, I am healthy. And his IM program, which is made up of three parts. One is a learn to swim program. The other is healthy eating. And the other piece is a goal setting. And Boys and Girls Clubs of America are benefiting from this program. And Special Olympics internationally are benefiting from this program. Over the last few years, we've traveled the globe, really, with Special Olympics. We've been to about, I don't even want to name 5 or 6 of their regions, where we have had the opportunity to train for about a week, special Olympic coaches who would then go back to their individual states or countries and train more coaches, so that when we went to the World Games for Special Olympics last year in August, we could really notice a difference. We could look at body position, the head position, and the way these athletes were taking their breathing and just really performing well. And it was very exciting to be able to see the fruits of the labor and to see this process that we use working for lots of people.
And it really has become more than just athletics. It's become, you know, health. And also, I understand maybe some economic influences, especially worldwide, as you open these swim schools. Maybe talk about that.
Well, we do. We have affiliates in the United States, and we have also partnered with a group in India. I spent a month there in 2015. We had another group spend a month there in the fall of spring of 2015, and then fall of 2015. We will continue to visit. That is a whole cultural change for them. Yes, they want the Olympic athlete, but as we all know, that starts in an infancy stage. Just like Michael, at 4 and 5 years old, he was taking lessons. In our particular curriculum, we talk about confidence, being comfortable, and being safe in the water. And once we feel that children and adults have that foundation, they are able to go on and do whatever it is that they want with swimming. So when we go to a place, when we were in India, for instance, I was so proud of the parents because many of the parents had never even put a toe in the water and had no intention of ever doing it, but they were entrusting their children to come to lessons, to take some lessons, to see the joy. And really some of the adults said, sign me up too, I'd like to have some lessons too. And it's been marvelous in our travels. And the same holds true with the Special Olympics and the special needs population.
And you talked about when we started that attention, given that the Olympics are coming up, how do you keep that momentum going even after the games in another, 6 to 7 weeks? How do you keep it going for the next 4 years?
You mean as far as going out and training and keeping this Learn to Swim program going?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Well, that is, if Michael's out there and he's swimming and we're watching and we are all living through that and enjoying that, and his messages bring swimming to more people. So as we all know, water is over 75% of our world is made up of water, and thousands and thousands and thousands of people don't know how to swim at all. So we have a big job ahead of us to try to get that word out and to get people comfortable and confident in the water. To get the drowning statistics are frightening, and something that we would really like to try to do something about through a Learn to Swim program. And then, as I said, the fun part is once you get that great base of a Learn to Swim, comfortable, confident in the water, and then you start using some higher level techniques, these country, states, places that are using the program will see a great improvement in their athletes. So we'll be able to see it from beginning to end, I hope.
Very good luck to Kathy Bennett and Michael Phelps as he continues his Olympic dreams and their work of the Michael Phelps Foundation. I'm Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your heart... Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
And a big hello to all of our Facebook Live viewers out there that are joining us. I hope you're all tuning in to watch The Sunny Side of Sports as part of our Watch on Wednesdays. But if you're not, don't worry. You can still watch. If you have internet or cellular access, you can tune in from our Facebook page. Just visit us at facebook.com/VOASunny. Well, joining me now in the studio is Jonah Haskell, who's here to talk about the latest trends in the sport world. Sporty greetings, Jonah.
Sporty greetings, Andrew.
So let's go back to a story we talked about just a couple minutes ago. Amare Stoudemire retiring from the National Basketball Association. I understand there's some social media buzz about that.
Yeah, he's getting a lot of buzz on social media. A lot of people are, going back into his career, remembering the great career that he has, going all the way back to 2003 when he was the Rookie of the Year. And they talk about when he played with the Suns, when he was with the Nuggets, and then, eventually when he came to the New York Knicks, who he signed a one-day contract with to be able to retire. And one thing that I thought was interesting about that is Stoudemire isn't really a... I live in New York. He's not really someone who gets a lot of love in New York. I think, he didn't play as well as people thought he would for the amount of money that the Knicks ended up paying him. But I saw on social media a lot of people are actually going back now and saying, oh, you know what, Mari, he was a good player, he was a good guy, and, we're going to miss him in the league.
Yeah, it's always when the players retire that's when they tend to get the praise on social media. Have you seen any other players that have been writing any messages of support or congratulations?
Yeah, I saw Carmelo Anthony posted something. Carmelo and Amari played together in New York for a while, and he posted, Matt, great to
great to play with you. Hope you have a good, you know, life now that you're retired. And so, you know, definitely players are getting out there and, you know, making sure that Amari knows that they appreciated him in the league.
And the four places that he played in Arizona, Florida, New York, and Texas. These are four of the biggest states in the country by population, and they're also kind of the four corners, more or less, of the United States. So I imagine there's a lot of outpouring of congratulations and support from all over the place.
Yeah, no, he definitely has, you know, sort of a national reach. It's not like he played in a small market, you know, pushed up in the corner of the country somewhere. He played in large markets and he played all over the country. So, you know, people from all walks of life, from all parts of the country are getting on social media today to, you know, pay their respects to him as he retires.
And to that point, he, you know, completed his career by signing that contract with the Knicks right before he retired so he could finish his NBA career as a New York Knicks. So congratulations again to him on his retirement. What else is out there trending in the sports world?
Well, also going on in the National Basketball Association, Tyronn Lue, the coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers, he got a new contract a couple days ago for $35 million over 5 years. Pretty big contract for a coach. And sort of the buzz on social media about it is that, well, Tyronn Lue, you know, it seems like he was a good coach. He did coach the team to the championship last year. Really, he owes that contract to LeBron James, who, you know, came out and is sort of coach of the team himself. You know, he definitely has a lot of say with what players they sign, what players they trade for, as well as probably the way that they play. I think him and Lou are somewhat, maybe not equals in the clubhouse, but LeBron James has, you know, a lot of power. And a lot of sort of the big buzz on social media is, you know, Tyronn Lue owes LeBron James a lot for this kind of contract because, you know, he wouldn't have won the championship without it, and, you know, without LeBron. And, you know, LeBron is just as big a part of that team, as big a part of what happens with that team as, you know, Lue is.
And I'm sure that contract number just going up and up and up as they made that run in the finals against the Golden State Warriors. Have any Cavs players reached out on social media to congratulate him or maybe say, hey, I want a piece of that? Maybe LeBron's coming out on Twitter and saying, hey, where's my cut?
Yeah, not as far as I've seen. You know, I've seen a lot of people posting that, oh, you know, now this might, you know, get players to want to come play in Cleveland because, oh, they saw, you know, if you're just around LeBron, LeBron just oozes success. So, you know, you go play with LeBron, you win. Maybe you get a little bit of credit for that, and suddenly you get a big contract as well. So we'll see if maybe it helps to maybe attract some more big free agents to Cleveland in years to come.
Yeah, maybe. And LeBron, I think, is oozing money, too, because as we've talked about on the Sunny Side of Sports, rumored payout from just his Nike endorsement of over $1 billion lifetime. That's the rumor anyway. So lots of success in Cleveland, not just on the court, but in the bank as well, I think. What else do you have that's trending out there?
Okay, well, Kevin Durant recently signed with the Golden State Warriors, coming over from Oklahoma City, played his first game last night in the Oracle Arena in Oakland, which is the home of the Golden State Warriors, except it wasn't for the Warriors. This time he was playing for the U.S. national team. They took on China, and the United States won that game 107-57.
Wow.
So a lot of buzz on social media about, you know, here's Durant. He's playing in Oakland. He got a big ovation from the fans there and also got, you know, a big introduction from the other Warriors players that are on the team. So people are excited about that. I did see that during the month of July, Durant's new Warriors jersey, which he hasn't even worn yet to play in, was the top-selling NBA jersey in 30 states.
Wow.
So, you know,
not even just California. We're talking, you know, 60% of the country here.
Yeah.
That's just speaks to how much attention he's getting in the offseason, certainly on social media. I want to go back to this crazy score, though, 107-57. I mean, that's you can't call it anything else but a blowout. Are people saying that this is maybe a sign of things to come in the Olympics for Team USA?
Yeah, definitely. People are, you know, people all over social media are looking at this, and they're coming out and saying, wow, look what we did to China. You know, China's not exactly a basketball power on the par of maybe Argentina or Brazil or Spain, but they're not bad. You know, it's the country that Yao Ming comes from, Hall of Famer. They've got some good players. And for the U.S. to come out and beat them like this by 50 points, you know, just really shows people are coming out and saying, you know, USA is going to go for the gold. Don't even worry about it. You know, why even play the games except, you know, to see these kind of exciting blowouts.
Well, we will see in the coming weeks as the Olympics get underway. Jonah Haskell, thank you very much for joining us. And that wraps up the July 27th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger, VOA engineer Nick Ivanov. And thank all of you out there in Radioland and on Facebook Live for tuning in. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young. And that's the sunny side of sports.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. government, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, in partnership with Ethiopia's Ministry of Health and implementing partners KNCV Tuberculosis Foundation, Management Sciences for Health, or MSH, and the World Health Organization, celebrated the transition from the Heal TB activity to Challenge TB at a recent event in Addis Ababa. Working closely with the Ministry of Health and the Amhara and Oromia Regional Health Bureaus, USAID's Heal TB activity has helped the ministry to screen more than 16 million people for TB since July 2011. While improving TB services at 1,000 health facilities was the original target, the activity enabled the ministry to expand to all 2,200 health facilities in the two regions. Implemented by MSH, together with its sub-partners Alert, PATH, and the Kenya Association for the Prevention of Tuberculosis and Lung Disease, HEAL-TB significantly strengthened the laboratory network for TB diagnosis and placed more than 250,000 people on treatment. Additionally, USAID created a model multi-drug-resistant program, integrated TB and HIV services, and expanded TB expertise at zonal and local levels. Ethiopia remains among the world's 30 high-burden TB countries, with close to 200,000 new cases estimated each year. Of these, only two-thirds are being identified for treatment. Ethiopia had approximately 1,300 new multi-drug-resistant cases in 2014, with less than 45% treated. The Challenge TB project is expected to substantially contribute to the government of Ethiopia's goal of ending TB throughout the country. It will build upon Heal TB and expand in scope to support the Ministry of Health in nearly all regions of Ethiopia. In alignment with the Health Sector Transformation Plan, Challenge TB will provide decentralized technical assistance to the government of Ethiopia at all levels to improve the quality of TB services, referral links, data, and reporting. It will also emphasize access to TB services by key populations. KNCV Tuberculosis Foundation is the lead implementing partner, with MSH and the World Health Organization substantially involved in project management. As USAID Mission Director Dennis Weller noted, we could not have achieved these results had it not been for our strong partnership and collaboration with the Ministry of Health and regional health bureaus.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Street Talk Africa. Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the Democratic National Convention and what a Hillary Clinton presidency could mean for Africa. Tune in to Street Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
The political party convention is a critical part of the American electoral process. VOA correspondents are there, reporting the latest developments.
Kane Faribault, VOA News, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Jim Malone, VOA News, at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
Tune in to VOA's extensive, up-to-the-minute coverage of the U.S. presidential election.